somehow shape the future. I would hope and pray I'd touch lives by the way I live today. Just one life. I wanna leave a legacy. Years from now, they'll see that I live only for the cause of Christ. Oh, to make a difference by living day to day as a reflection of God.
Hey everyone, Steve Donahue here with the Legacy Podcast. This is episode number 225, and this is going to be a sermon that I recently preached to the church in which I pastor, Mount Tabor Baptist Church, from Esther chapter 3. And in Esther chapter 3 is where we hear of the great conflict between Mordecai and Haman. It really is kind of the climax of the story, and shows why the rest of the story has to take place. And so Esther is a great book, and this is a great chapter in the book, and hopefully you will be able to gain some great information from this. Before we actually look at that, though, I want to direct your attention to a few announcements and some resources. First of all, if you're not a registered user, I encourage you to do that. That way you can know anytime that there is new updates to the website or anything like that, you'll be notified through email. Anytime there's a new feed or something like that, a new post, you'll be notified. Also, if you haven't yet subscribed through iTunes, there is a show notes link to the iTunes feed, and I encourage you to do that. You can also, of course, do that through the webpage itself. And if you haven't given me a feedback on iTunes after you register, that would be a great thing to do. That enables more people to find us on iTunes, so I appreciate you doing that. If you want to support the show, the best way of doing that is becoming a Legacy Partner. There's all kinds of information about how to do that, and you will benefit with some products that I have and some discounts to some other things, and you can check out all the things that are available for you in that. If you haven't yet heard my new podcast, which is a homeschool podcast called thehomeschoolhope.com, you can go over there and listen to some of that. And then, of course, another way you can support the show is by checking out the endorsed affiliates. We have five of those, and they are listed on the webpage as well as in the show notes. And I encourage you to access those as you see fit and have a need. And that way I get a little bit of commission on that. Appreciate you doing that. But thanks most importantly for listening. And I'm hoping that this is a blessing to you. And so here you go. Here is Esther chapter 3.
In the 1960s, of course, was when the Andy Griffith series came out. And I'm sure you are familiar with the Andy Griffith show and probably have watched some of them. And I was told that there is a sermon illustration in every Andy Griffith show. And it may be true. I have one this morning. And I don't know, some of you have probably seen the show before. I don't remember exactly which episode it was, but it was called A Feud is a Feud. Do you remember that one? Basically, what happens is that this young couple wants to get married, but they're from rival families. And so in the middle of the night, they wake up the Taylor household. Of course, Andy is being the sheriff. He's kind of the justice of the peace, and so he does the marriage. And so they wake up Andy and the rest of the family to get married. And he barely gets started when in walks Hannah's father, bursting through the door with shotgun ready. And, of course, he stops the wedding at gunpoint, followed by Josh's father, who is going to be the groom. And he does the same thing, comes in barging with shotgun ready. And it seems that the Carters and the Wakefields have been feuding for years, and the patriarchs aren't about to let any of theirs marry one of ours. And so Andy backs down. The next morning, Andy decides the best course of action is to end the feud before marrying the couple, and so he visits both the fathers. He learns that their feud has been going on for years. In fact, 87 years their feud had been going on. So Andy proposes to solve it by a duel. And so he sets up this duel between the two rival families, and of course they both run away when the time comes to actually start the shooting. And so Andy decides to go ahead and marry Josh and Hannah at gunpoint. And of course they marry. And we can laugh at that story, and we can think to ourselves, that's the Andy Griffith show, oh, that's great. But the reality of it is, there are feuds that have occurred through history and through time that are significant. And one of the most significant is that between the Jews and the Agagites. And we're going to see a little bit of that history here played out in chapter 3. The principles we will learn from this are important today because, as much as we would like to dismiss it, the root of such things are still present in today as well. And so in chapter 3, verse 1, we see the background. But before we actually look at that, I want us to pick up with the last verse of chapter 2. It says, "And when an inquiry was made into the matter," if you recall, this was the assassination plot on King Ahasuerus. And it says that when this plot was inquired, the matter was found out and it was confirmed, and both were hanged on the gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Now, if you recall, who was it that informed the king that this was an attack upon his life? It was Mordecai. And yet the very next verse of chapter 3 says, "And after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman." Well, now this doesn't seem fair. Mordecai should be the one who's being promoted, right? He's the one who informed the king of the assassination plot, and yet the very next verse says that after these things, Haman is promoted. And it says that Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. So he gets basically second in command. Of all the princes, all the rulers, the Agagite Haman is promoted. Now, in order for us to understand the real implications of this, in the context of this, we need to go back a few chapters. In fact, all the way back to Exodus chapter 17. Turn back there with me, if you will. Exodus chapter 17, and we'll pick up with verse 8. And, of course, Exodus chapter 17 is dealing with the deliverance of the Israelites out of Egypt, and they are in the wilderness wandering, waiting to take in or to go into the promised land. And it says in chapter 17, verse 8, it says this: "Now Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said to Joshua, 'Choose us some men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand.'" And then the remainder of the passage talks about how when Moses' hands were raised up, Joshua was able to go, and they were able to win the victory. But then when Moses' hands dropped down, they had difficulty in it. So verse 13, it says, "So Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword." Verse 14, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven.' And Moses built an altar and called its name, 'The Lord is my banner.' For he said, 'Because the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation.'" Now, turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 15. This also gives us some context as to this struggle that we see in Esther chapter 3. 1 Samuel chapter 15. And of course, this is the time of Saul. The Exodus took place about 1400 BC. Saul lived about 1000 BC. And so this is 400 years later. It's about 600 years before the time of Esther, give or take. And so in chapter 15, it says, "Samuel also called to Saul, 'The Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people, over Israel. Now, therefore, heed the voice of the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek.'" Remember who the Amalekites were? The Amalekites? They were those who resisted and fought with Israel when they were coming out into the wilderness. And God punished them and said, basically, I'm going to fight against them. I'm going to destroy them and annihilate them for you. So it says here in verse 2, thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he ambushed him on the way when he camped up from Egypt. That's referring to what we just read in Exodus chapter 15. Now go and attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. So Saul gathered the people together and numbered them in Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men of Judah. And Saul came to the city of Amalek and lay in wait in the valley. Then Saul said to the Kenites, go, depart, get down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them. For you showed kindness to all the children of Israel when they came out of Egypt. So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. So he lets the Kenites go because they showed kindness to Israel when they were in the wilderness wandering. But the Amalekites, he's destined for destruction. Verse 7, so Saul attacked the Amalekites from Havilah all the way to Shur, which is east of Egypt. He also took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive. Well, now here we have a problem. What was he supposed to do with all the Amalekites? He was supposed to utterly destroy them all, wasn't he? And yet, what does it say in verse 8? He also took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword, but Saul and the people spared Agag. Anytime there's a repetition of something in the scriptures, it's there to emphasize this is a serious thing. So in the verse right before it, it says, he spared Agag. Now it says, he spared Agag. The oxen, the fatlings of the lambs, and all that was good, and were unwilling to utterly destroy them, but everything despised and worthless, that they utterly destroyed. And so, when Saul was commanded to go and to kill all the Amalekites, he killed all of the Amalekites except for Agag. And he destroyed all of the bad things that was under them, and when he was commanded to destroy all of everything that they had. Well, now, 600 years later, what do we find? We find Haman, the Agagite, being promoted. This is a feud that has occurred for over 1,000 years between these two families, between the Jews and the Agagites or the Amalekites. And so it's not surprising what we find in the rest of the chapter here. In verse 2 through 4, what we find is Mordecai refusing to pay homage to this Agagite. Verse 2, it says, and all the king's servants who were within the king's gates bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him, but Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Now, some have understood this to think that, well, that was because Mordecai didn't want to bow down to anybody because he was a Jew, and Jews only bowed down to God. But that's not what we find in the scriptures. In fact, we find many cases where the Jews were bowing down in honor and in homage to those who were in authority over them. And so that can't be what's being identified here. The reason why Mordecai is not bowing down to Haman is because of this feud. He realizes who Haman is as being the Agagite, and he, of course, being a Jew. And what makes it even more important is if you recall who Mordecai was, it says that he was a direct descendant of Saul. So here we have the king who was supposed to destroy all of them, actually preserving Agag's life, and now Agag's great-great-great-grandchild is now trying to fight against Saul's great-great-grandchild. There's a few more greats in there, but for the sake of time, I spared you some of that. Verse 3. Then the king's servants who were with the king's gate said to Mordecai, why do you transgress the king's command? Now it happened when they spoke with him daily and he would not listen to them. Now, sometimes when we read the scriptures, we have to kind of put ourselves in the position of those that are being spoken about. And I can't help but think kind of what's going on here is they see Mordecai not bowing down. Every time that this Haman goes by, maybe riding in a horse or something like that, and everybody bows down, but Mordecai stands there stiff-necked. Won't bow down. And afterwards, he goes by or whatever, and they come up to Mordecai and say, Mordecai, what are you doing? Don't you realize that this is the king's command, that if you don't bow down to Haman, you're going to die? Come on, buddy. We like you. Don't put yourself on the chopping block like this. And it says I don't know how long they did this, it doesn't say, but it says daily they went to him. Now maybe it was that every morning Haman would come out, or every morning he'd go into the palace or whatever it was, and each time they bowed down. And each time Mordecai would not bow down. And finally it says they had enough of it. And so they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. I don't know whether they're thinking to themselves, look, maybe if he just comes out and actually addresses Mordecai directly, maybe Mordecai will bow down. Or maybe they thought, you know what, this guy's this bad, maybe we just need to get rid of him. Maybe we need to tell Mordecai or tell Haman, Haman will come and take care of Mordecai, whatever it was. I'm not sure exactly what they're thinking at this point. But they go and they tell Haman that Mordecai is not bowing down, for Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. So apparently he said, look, And this is kind of how I see Mordecai expressing it to his friends. They're telling him, look, Mordecai, you've got to bow down. If you don't bow down, it's going to be your death sentence. It's just bow down. He's just a ruler. Just bow down to him. It's not a big deal. And I can hear Mordecai saying to them, I will never bow down to that Agagite. Can you kind of picture Mordecai saying that? So verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down and pay him homage, Mordecai was filled with wrath. Now up until this point, I don't know whether Haman had actually seen Mordecai or not. And it may be that after he had heard word that Mordecai was not bowing down, he specifically went in front of Mordecai to see how he would respond. And it says that when he found out that Mordecai would not bow down and pay him homage, it says that he was filled with wrath. But he was able to compose himself to some extent because he realized, look, if I just kill Mordecai, it's not enough. I've got to kill off all these Jews. So verse 6, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. So verse 5 through 7, we see this, or 5 through 9, we see Haman's plot to kill off all of these Jews. And in verse 7, it says, in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur, that is lots, before Haman to determine the day and the month until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Now, scriptures tell us that man throws down the lot, but that God actually orchestrates the events that take place and the timing of all of that. And so we know, and specifically the time frame at which this is being spoken about is the very day before the Jews celebrated the Passover is when this is all taking place. So the day in which the Jews are to remember God's great deliverance of the people of Israel out of Egypt is the very time at which their destruction is being orchestrated. Isn't that interesting? So verse 8, then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples. Isn't it interesting when there is a feud of some kind, when there is a racial cleansing, when there is a genocide, when there is something like that taking place in a land, it's always because the other people are different. Isn't it? Well, that's what's going on here. He's coming to the king and he's saying, look, there's a group of people in your kingdom and they are different. Now, the Babylonian kingdom, the Assyrian kingdom, the Persian Median kingdom, it was made up of all kinds of people. Not just Jewish people, it was Greeks and there was Egyptians and there was some remnants from the Babylonians. There were some remnants from the Assyrians. The Assyrians, of course, they intermingled with all kinds of people. And so there's this whole melting pot of people. And yet Haman singles out the Jews as being different. And in some ways they were, because they kept to the laws of God. There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all the other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. Now, so far, the only law that we see them not keeping is what? Not bowing down to Haman. And now, we don't know whether all the Jews didn't do this, or whether this was just Mordecai that didn't bow down. But he is, of course, lumping them all together and saying that this is a real problem. So in verse 9, it says, "If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasury." So Haman is not dumb. He devises this plan, but he realizes what some of the objections of the king might be. If they go and destroy all the Jews, and the Jews under the Persian Empire were quite prosperous. They were bringing in quite a bit of revenue into the king's treasuries. And so to kill off all of the Jews would have meant a lack of revenue for the king. And the king was probably at this time in great need of revenue, because if you recall, he had come back from a failed campaign against the Greeks. 3 years he had fought against the Greeks. That takes a lot of money. He didn't have a Federal Reserve like we do, where they can just print some more. They have to come up with it somehow. And so having a need for this revenue, Haman is wise in trying to say, look, I'll take care of the revenue. Now, Haman was probably thinking, if we destroy all these Jews, we'll just confiscate what they had. We'll take that, turn it into gold or silver or whatever it is, and we'll put it into the treasury of the king. No problem. Verse 10. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. Now, again, this is the second time that he's mentioned as an Agagite, the enemy of the Jews, which seems to indicate the reason for all of this. And I think it's interesting to note here, too, the passivity of King Ahasuerus. I mean, King Ahasuerus is just kind of going along with whatever Haman is saying that he should do. He didn't inquire as to who these people were. His own wife was one of them. And yet he's like, yeah, okay, Haman, sure, no problem. Here's my ring. Whatever you want to do. In fact, what does he say? He says, the king said to Haman, the money and the people are given to you to do with them as seems good to you. He's just relegating his power pretty much at this point. He's basically saying, whatever, Haman, yeah. Sure, you want to kill off some people in our country? Yeah, go ahead. I'll decree it. Now, there's something else going on here that we need to be aware of, and it's really important. And there's always a story behind the story when it comes in the Bible. We can see the details of what's going on here, and we can see the outward expression of men's actions and decisions that they're making. But there's an underlying thread in the Scriptures, and that is the war between God and Satan that began even in the garden. And if you recall, in chapter 3 of Genesis, it says that Satan will attempt to destroy man. It says he'll wound his heel. But it says that the Lord will smite his head. I mean, the Lord will get the victory in the end. And ever since that time, Satan has been behind the scenes working to try to destroy God's plan of redemption. And so think about this. If Haman's plan succeeds and all the Jews are wiped out, what happens to the Messiah? There is no Messiah. He has to come from the line of David. He has to come from the Messianic line, or there is no Messiah. That's what all the prophecies are saying. And so behind the scenes, we have to realize Haman's plot is not just a bad man's plot against a family jealous feud. There's something spiritual going on. There's an attempt to destroy the plan of God. So verse 10 through 14, we see the issue of the decree. We've already looked at verse 10 and 11. Verse 12 then says, "Then the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and the decree was written, according to all that Haman commanded, to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over every province, to the officials, and to all the people, to every province according to their script, and to every people in their language. In the name of King Ahasuerus, it was written and sealed with the king's signet ring." Now, we don't have a record here in our English Bibles of what was written. But if you look at the Septuagint, which is actually a Greek translation of the Old Testament, and the book of Esther is particularly interesting because there's a lot of additional material that's added in the Septuagint. One of the materials added is actually the letter that was written by King Ahasuerus. And I read that in preparation for this. And what I found very interesting about that letter is that the reason that King Ahasuerus says in there for the extermination of the Jews is the safety of the people. Now, what I find interesting about that is, what is the main reason we find so many laws being passed in our own land? It's for safety, isn't it? That is always the catchphrase that rulers use to impose more restrictions upon people, to cause more violence in their land, is actually, they say, look, we need to do a little bit of violence in order to protect against more violence. But the reality of it is, were the Jews really that violent? It's the same thing happening today in our cultures, in our day.
Hitler.
Exactly. What rulers will decree to put into law for the safety of others? What violence, killing has been done in the name of the protection of national security? You know, Hitler's exterminations were because he convinced the people that there was a certain groups within Germany that were causing other groups not to prosper. Sound familiar? And so he called for the extermination of those certain groups. Ethnic cleansing and genocide are practiced today by many countries. And we think about our own country and we say, well, that would never happen in America. Really? I cannot, and I'm going to, this is not in my notes, okay? So, I remember growing up and flying on an airplane and it being fun. Because you got to go on an airplane, go through the airports, you always got to, you know, get the airport food, and, you know, I mean, there was some neat things associated with travel. I hate traveling on an airplane now. You know why? Because you pretty much have to undress, take off everything, have everything go through scanners. Why? Because of the safety of the people. Now, are the terrorists really going to attack on an airplane again? Nope. So why in the world did that stuff get passed? Take away the freedoms of the people. That's why. All right, I'm off my hobby horse there. Governments love to use violence on one group in order to supposedly preserve another group. Verse 14, then the law is published and made clear to all. And then we find the reaction in verse 15. It says, the couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan the citadel. So the king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city of Shushan was perplexed. You notice the contrast of response there? They get this issued decree saying, we're going to exterminate all the Jews in the land on this day. Get ready. And they get this and they say, why? What have they done? What's the problem? They're my neighbors. They're the people I do business with. They're not causing a problem. But Haman and the king sit down to drink. So what are some principles that we can glean, some lessons that we can learn from chapter 3 of Esther? Well, the first one is this. Actions of one generation have consequences for future generations. Actions of one generation have consequences for future generations. Actually, more to the point, actions have consequences, period. and they often last longer than what we want. We learn from this chapter the failure of Saul to fully obey God and to put to death all of the Amalekites, and as a result, Agag lives. His descendants live even to the time of Mordecai, to the point where they are the enemies of the Jews. This is not to say that the principle is that we are to kill off those that are opposed to us. That's not what the scriptures say. That was a specific command for a specific time, for a specific situation that God commanded for the people of Israel to do. The principle that can be applied, though, there is clear, and that is that disobedience in one generation can cause great problems for later generations. We don't need to look far to see the reality of this in our present day or even in our own lives, do we? Now, we know from the scriptures that judgment is for a specific person. In fact, in Ezekiel chapter 18, verse 20, it says, "The soul who sins shall die. The son shall not bear the guilt of the father, nor the father bear the guilt of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon himself." So judgment is specific to the person. But consequences often linger and last longer than the actual judgment. Principle happens to us as well. You know, look at our nation, for example. I didn't vote for the debt that we have, and you probably didn't either. I didn't vote for the unfunded liabilities that are present. I didn't vote for the mandates, the regulations, the taxes that are upon us. And yet the consequences are some generation did. And so we have what we have. Even more to the point, though, there are people born all over the world that are born into worse circumstances than our own by far. Do these people get born into these circumstances because of some prior bad karma or something like that? No, we don't believe in karma. And yet, there is a clarity to the idea that consequences of one generation's sins and disobedience are very often passed on to the next. I think of a baby being born with fetal alcohol syndrome, or a baby that is born with crack because of the sins and the disobedience of their parents. We must be careful that we don't claim every problem is a result of past generations. In fact, some of the disciples of Jesus came to this conclusion. And in John chapter 9, verse 1 through 3, we see this recorded. "Now as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, 'Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?' Jesus answered, 'Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him.'" And so we can't claim that every problem that we encounter is a result of the decisions of people that have taken place prior to us. But at the same time, we have to understand that sin has consequences. There is a direct line between the two. So what should we do with this? Well, first of all, we should repent of our own sin and disobedience, if not for ourselves, for the generations that take place after us. Maybe you are doing something that you should not be doing at the present. You know, I remember, I've been really working hard on this. It's not by any means a success yet in my life. But I remember growing up, some of my family yelled a lot. And I told myself, when I have kids and when I get married, I'm never going to yell. Well, I'm working on that. You know, maybe you're a yeller. Maybe you have a problem with drinking. Maybe you have a problem with debt or financial bondage. Maybe you have a problem with your marriage or in relationships. We never know the extent of the consequences of these problems in our life until generations to come. And we see the problem has been passed on from one generation to the next. You never know the amount of trauma that could be causing from your bad decisions. But that's not all just from the negative. We also don't do some things that has consequences as well. For example, we don't read our Bible as we should. And as a result, we're not spiritually attuned as we should, and so we don't train our children as we should. We don't have family altar and disciple our children. We don't participate in evangelism. We don't love our brothers, sisters as we should. We don't attend worship regularly. And these are all ways in which we do things and don't do things that we should be and should not be. And as a result of that, those actions have consequences. And we need to seriously ask ourselves, is there something in our life that is going to negatively affect the generations to come. If you want to mess up your life, that's one thing. But when you decide to do something that messes up the life of those that come on after you, that's a whole other matter. And so we need to repent of our own sins and our disobedience that for ourselves may mess up the generations to come. But secondly, we also need to forgive those who have done wrong to us and stop our victim mentality. You know, we spend a lot of time in our world playing the blame game, don't we? Happens all the time. What is the blame game? Victim mentality. It's this idea that we're victims because of the circumstances that we live in. Because our parents did this, or because this happened to us, we became this way. We should not be surprised at this, because this was actually the very first response that Adam and Eve had. If you remember back in the garden, after Adam and Eve sinned, and God comes to Adam and he says, "Adam, have you eaten of the fruit?" And what does Adam say? He says, "Yes, I take full responsibility." No. What did he say? He says, "That woman that you gave me." It'd be one thing if he's just blaming the woman, but he blames God for giving her to him. Makes it all the worse, right? So he says, "Okay, well, we'll deal with you in a minute. Eve, what did you do?" And Eve said, "It was Satan. It was the serpent that tempted me." But they're casting blame, right? That's just only natural. On a lighter note, I've heard it said this way before, that usually when men get married, they put on a few pounds. And it always goes like this: "Yeah, I put on 15 pounds, but can't help it, you know, if my wife's good cooking." They're casting the blame upon their wife. Now, that's an innocent example, right? Of casting the blame for something that we should be responsible for ourselves. We must get beyond the blame game and take ownership for our own actions. You know, we all have dysfunction of one kind or another growing up, don't we? I mean, our parents weren't perfect. They had problems. All of us had parents that had problems. And it's time that we move beyond that. So then let us first consider our own actions and repent of anything that may have negative consequences for future generations. And secondly, forgive those who may have given us bad experiences from the past. Pray for God to help you in doing these things. I think the second principle that we can... Oh, my goodness, I am way past time. The second principle that I'm getting excited about this passage. I love this. I love Esther. Chapter 2, though, the second principle is that bigotry and racism have a history. Bigotry and racism have a history. You know, it's deep-rooted in hatred. In this case, it was the hatred between the Jews and the Agagites that went back over 500 years. In fact, beyond that, 1,000 years to the time of Exodus. That is a long time for those roots to develop deep. On Mordecai's part, it was a hatred that resulted in an unwillingness to bow down. And on Haman's part, it was a hatred that resulted in a desire to kill off all of the Jews. There's a history to such feuds. It's not as though one day Mordecai woke up and said, "You know what? I think I'm just not going to show any respect to Haman today." Nor is it one day that Haman woke up and said, "You know what? I think I'm going to kill off all the Jews today." There was this hatred, there was this feud that was taking place between those two groups for a long time. There was a history behind racism and hatred and feuding. This is true in bigotry and hatred towards another human being based on family or ethnicity or the like today as well. Take, for example, the relationship between the white man and Native Americans. The U.S. government, consisting mostly of white men at the time, did unbelievable atrocities to the Native Americans in the past. We should not wonder then that there might be some tension between the two groups. There's a history there. The same thing can be true about blacks and whites. There's a history there. We can't deny that. And so some of the actions that people take are a result of the history that has developed in deep rootedness. The principle can even be seen on a family-to-family scale. What makes the Hatfields and the McCoys such a household name? You know the Hatfields and McCoys, West Virginia feuding took place, right? It was because of years and years of history that had developed between those two families. So what are we to do with this principle? Number one, acknowledge the fact that bigotry exists and is often rooted in long history. Secondly, allow for grace. Understand that some people are coming to the perspective with a different perspective on the history. And then third, move on. If you are a part of such a conflict, move on. Ask God to give you the grace to forgive and to move past the history into the future. And then thirdly, I'll try to cover this real quick, although it's the most important point. The hand of God is at work. Now, we're left at this story in chapter 3, as I mentioned already, with this great dilemma of what's going to happen to God's people. This is the promised nation, the one that was going to bring in the Messiah. This was the nation that had been told that they were going to be the ones who were going to bring in the promise. And now, there's a decree for their extermination. What's going to happen? Is he going to allow his people to be destroyed on the very day before the celebration of his delivering them out of Egypt with his strong hand? What's going to happen with this genocidal decree? We'll have to wait to hear the rest of the story. Unless you want to go home and read the rest of it, you can certainly do that. You've probably heard it before. But we will cover the rest of it. But consider all these details, which if did not occur, the story would totally change. That is, Haman was promoted. Remember, Mordecai was supposed to be promoted. Haman, though, is promoted, so he has better access and ability to the king. If he was not promoted, then it would not have access to the king and convince him to decree to kill the Jews. Mordecai was in proximity to Haman to be noticed as disrespectful. If Mordecai had just gone along, submitted, none of this would have happened. Haman convinced the king the need to exterminate the Jews. If Haman would not have been able to do this, then the king would not have been able to issue the decree, and none of this would have happened. The king issues a decree to allow for the Jews' extermination. If the king had not done this, the outcome would have been vastly different. And we can see then that the outcome is dependent upon all these things taking place just in the way that they took place, in the time in which they took place, and in the way in they took place. Coincidence? Nope. We don't believe in coincidences, do we? It was the hand of God working through the events and the decisions of men. Even though the name of God is absent from the story of Esther, He's not. And you know, it brings up an important principle, and that is very often when we are in the midst of a situation, it's hard to see the hand of God at work. It's only when we look in the rearview mirror that we can see the hand of God. And we know the rest of the story, Esther. We can look back. We can see how all of these events are working out for His plan and His purpose. And yet when you're in the midst of the trial, when you're in the midst of the situation, it seems so different. So let's review. Sins of one generation have consequences for following generations, so be warned. Bigotry and racism often have deep-rooted history, so we must be gracious. The hand of God is at work, so we must trust God. We are left in the story with the decree to exterminate the Jews on the day before the celebration of God's deliverance from them out of Egypt. The question we are left with, is God going to deliver them? And if so, how? God willing, next week we will continue with Esther and get more details into this dramatic story.
If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? But just like the plant that withers away, we will leave many seeds behind. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? If today you lost your life, see what happened in the dash between your birth and death. What will you do to change your legacy? What will you do?